Well, welcome everyone. How many people were in the class upstairs with Ben this morning? Zen has a peculiarity, and that is a lack of instruction. And Tim Burkett, our abbot, talks about when he worked with Suzuki Roshi, he would say, "What should I do?" And Suzuki would say, "Just sit. Just sit, or arrange your shoes in a certain way," if you remember his stories. So today what I'd like to do is offer eight practical spiritual practices. And these are spiritual practices that anyone in any religion, for example, can adapt. And I'll talk about that. And I'm addressing particularly some of the concerns of people who are new here, if you will. And these eight practices should be practiced every day and together, even if for a while. There are a lot of misconceptions, and this is for people who are new to Zen, misconceptions about what meditation and spiritual practice are all about. Some people enter fearfully thinking this is a cult. It's not a cult. One way you can tell the depth of a person's understanding is to watch how they interact with others. Are they attentive? Do they listen? Are they humble? Things like this. So our practice really is about living fully with other people every day. Hardly a cult. Another misconception is that meditation really means that you make your mind blank. And I swear my mind is blank at times. But our brains are idea generators. And as much as we'd like, they generate ideas. And anyone who has meditated a fair amount realizes that there's just a constant stream, basically, of thoughts. And so meditation really has to do in part of how you deal with that constant stream, a stream that never goes away. A third misconception is the idea that somehow meditation is hard thought. And it's like Rodin's The Thinker. Remember that statue with furrowed brow? You're sitting there and thinking hard. And in my view, meditation really is about basically training the mind. The Buddha famously said, "You are what you have thought. You are what you have thought." And through meditation, by thinking about what we think and changing it, etc., now we can change our life. And that basically is the heart of the spiritual path, if you will. And everyone has this capacity. No one is excluded. If we all sit and meditate and have a plan and work at it, etc., we can all attain these goals. It's not easy. The mind's a trickster. We'll talk about that a little bit, etc. It's like a salmon swimming upstream. It's easy to float through life downstream. We're just leaves. We do what everyone else does. Our friends ask us to do certain things, etc. That may not be good. It may not be healthy. It may not be thoughtful, etc. So like the salmon, we turn and we swim upstream. And if you know something about salmon, salmons get tired. Those little fins flap, etc. They get tired, and it's not easy. It's easier to turn and float downstream, etc. So we need these practices a little bit, and we want to do them every day a little bit. When you meditate and practice a spiritual life, regardless of the tradition, you have three great revelations. Explain what I mean by that a little bit. And we actually have to look at some of the thought structure of Eastern ways of life. And they think a little different. I'll just name five. Well, one is basically that what we should study is not the trees and the rocks outside. That's fine. But what we study basically is what arises within. And that's our primary focus, what arises within. A second understanding, and these are kind of part of a world view, is that when knowledge comes, it comes through revelation or experience or understanding. It's not like a scientist slowly accumulating facts. It's experiential. So when I say, I know something, I'm saying, I know something here, you know, in the body, you know, not up here. And I've spent my life as an academic up here. And when I taught my first course here, and Buddhism was all up here, etc. And the more courses I teach, I find myself teaching from here, if you will. So that's a second great principle, that the source of our knowledge really is experiential. It's revelation, if you will. And then there are a number of principles that the world is hierarchical. And we all know this basically from physics, we know a little bit about physics, and we look and we see walls and we see water and we see roads, etc. And we have a little bit of physics and we learn about molecules, we learn about atoms, we learn about quarks, right? And so we realize the world is layered and we just tend to see it in a certain way. In Buddhism they talk about the three worlds. Now you can live in the world of your ordinary senses. So when we look, we see a lake, we see a wall, we see a road, we see cars, which are really products of our thoughts and our concepts and our imagination, etc. On the very top, of course, we see what that is, you know, how it's composed, how our language, how our culture, etc., forms what we see. And our goal as spiritual beings is to walk that path in between, where we live in the world of lakes and walls and cars, but we clearly see what it's made of and how it influences us, if you will. So back to these three great realizations or revelations when you meditate. And the first is the realization that you're not your body. And for many people, this is startling. And it's not just intellectual. You feel it here. Now, whatever you can see, you are not. Whatever you can see, you're not, etc. And so that realization has all kinds of implications, etc. If you're not your body, then you watch it. And you watch what it wants. You know what I mean? How it misbehaves. Things like this. But even more importantly, when you look at other people, you see that they're just wearing garments. Your body is your ultimate costume, etc. So whether you're old or young, male or female, large or small, black or white or brown, etc., it's just the ultimate costume. And so by letting your body drop away, etc., has great implications for your understanding, etc. And so when you look at people, you don't judge them by their ultimate costume, as much fun as costumes are, etc. And they are fun, but you look inside. You look inside. Now, the second great revelation is you're not your mind. You're not your mind. Many people go through life thinking they are their mind. What comes up? And remember, the brain is just a thought generator. It just generates these things. And we get caught up with it. And we think we're our mind. Now, there's a whole movement today in education where they're trying to teach children reflection. And we know it better as mindfulness. When they tried to introduce mindfulness into Southern schools, it was too closely related to Buddhism. So they had to change the word, and they changed it to reflection. And so there's a movement today to teach kids the 4 R's, you know, writing, arithmetic, reading, and reflection, etc. And what kid learns when they're young to look inward and reflect and think of their mind as not them. Ru Jing, who was Dogen's Chinese teacher, said the practice of Zen is a dropping away of body and mind. And this is exactly what he meant. When you read Dogen, Dogen describes his enlightenment as the dropping away of body and mind. And that's what this is, just the realization that you're not your body, that you're not your mind. And then the third great realization is the realization of who you really are. And it has various words, witness, observer, you know, whoever, supreme reality, whatever. And it's that that sits and observes the body and the mind and the world around it. And just because you drop your body and mind away doesn't mean there's not a lot of work to do. Because there's all kinds of phases of consciousness, etc., that one goes through. In Zen, you know, this is pictured in what we call the 10 ox herder pictures. And the first person is out there looking for the track of the ox. That is, we're on the spiritual trail, you know, looking for a whiff. Then you see a little bit, you see a footprint. Eventually you see the ox, you tame the ox, which is a metaphor for the mind, of course. And then eventually you realize that drops away. And so as you move through the 10 ox herder pictures, etc., you're moving up this level of consciousness. A lot of this is described, as far as I'm concerned, just wonderfully in an old book called The Three Pillars of Zen by Philip Kefla, who talks about this and gives many, many illustrations of what this sounds like actually in Dokusan. It's a wonderful book where he was able to actually sit in during Dokusan sessions, and so you can actually see basically what all of this means, if you will. So what about our eight teachings? And the first is meditation. And there are many ways to meditate, and basically they fall into two kind of schools, if you will. Two purposes, if you will. The first is to really stabilize the mind. And we call that mindfulness, where you're, if you had your class, you're talking about focusing on the breath, etc. The second is illumination or awareness, where you're actually, you know, becoming aware basically of the nature of your thoughts, and you're watching them, and you're doing something with them. And sometimes this is called shikantaza in Zen, and sometimes our form of meditation is called the way of illumination, the way of illumination, where you're illuminating these thoughts, if you will, etc. The Buddha opened his great book, the Dhammapada, with this magnificent line. He said, "All that we are is a result of what we have thought. All that we are is what we have thought." And so basically through meditation, etc., we concentrate upon basically what we thought. In Zen, a lot of times basically we look at our breath, we just observe what's there. Another approach I find very useful basically is to have to memorize an inspirational passage. And so you know, you repeat it and repeat it and repeat it in meditation. And when I say meditation, I'm talking about sitting on a cushion, you know, usually for a half hour is just about the right amount of time. And so here's just the beginning of a passage on goodwill by the Buddha. "May all beings be filled with joy and peace. May all beings everywhere, the strong and the weak, the great and the small, the mean and the powerful, the short and the long, the subtle and the gross. May all beings everywhere, seen and unseen, dwelling far off or nearby, being or waiting to become, may all be filled with lasting joy." And then it goes on. Remember, you are what you think. You are what you think. And every religion has spiritual passages like that. And here's a passage by St. Francis, and it's his prayer. And it says, "Lord," and if you have trouble with words like God and Lord, just substitute ultimate reality, if you will. And that's all, really. "Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy." And then it goes on, and you memorize these passages. And you let them fall inward. You know, you bring them into your heart, basically, if you will. But remember, if you've meditated a lot, you know the mind is a trickster. and it's trying to lure you out of attention in all kinds of ways, etc. It may be a nice image, it may be a thought about food, things like this. Also, one has the idea that when you meditate, suddenly everything is great. And I mean, there's peace and calm and serenity, etc. And it's nearly always just the opposite. That if you hadn't paid attention to your mind, etc., there are terrible forces there. Or in many cases, there are terrible forces and they come up. And so often the first years of meditation, you have to deal with those forces that come up. They were there, you just haven't recognized them, etc. And thus, we need a teacher, if you will. There are lots of good books of instruction. This one on meditation by Eknath Iswaran is a good one. And Eckhart says, if all else fails when you try to meditate, follow instructions. So you may be familiar with that expression. If all else fails, follow instructions, etc. And so if you're starting a practice, etc., you want to start with a clear idea, basically, of what you want to do. An image I found very useful is that of the Shambhala warrior. The idea is that the greatest struggle and battle you can have in your life is with yourself, with your mind, and with the wants of your body, etc. And so some people find it useful to think of themselves as the Shambhala warrior, this kind of thing, etc. But remember, what you're trying to obtain is glorious beyond compare. And I use that expression specifically because I was started out as a Catholic, and I had all these great images of glory, you know what I mean, and glorious, beatific, etc. And of course, we've kind of let that drop away, but it truly is a glorious goal. Well, the second great practice, if you will, is using a mantra. And we don't talk much about mantras in Zen, if you will. But what's the value of a mantra? In ancient India, they used to have great parades through the village. And there was always these great lines of elephants. And the elephants would go through the village. But an elephant's trunk is very active and very curious. And so it would go through the markets, etc., and reach over and two coconuts were gone. It would reach over, bananas were gone. And of course, the people selling these things would become irate. So what do you do with an elephant's trunk? You give the elephant a bamboo shaft to hold on to. And wanting to be a good elephant, the elephant holds it proudly, right? So it's not able to grab bananas and coconuts and things like that. And in a very real sense, our mind is like an elephant's trunk. It flits here, it grabs here, it moves here, etc. And so by repeating a mantra daily, whenever you have a time, you ride the bus, you have a few minutes, etc., you're training your mind, etc. Mahatma Gandhi said, the mantra becomes one's staff of life and carries one through every ordeal. It is not repeated for the sake of repetition, but for the sake of purification. It is an aid to effort. It is no empty repetition, for each repetition has a new meaning, carrying you nearer and nearer to God, or our supreme reality, if you will. And his mantra was Rama, R-A-M-A, Rama, which means to rejoice, to rejoice. And every mantra basically has a meaning. In Christianity, and many of us have a Christian background, or may still be Christians, etc., mantras are often called the holy name. So it's Jesus, Jesus. Or Hail Mary, Hail Mary. Something like this. And oftentimes you say it with the rosary, etc. In Buddhism, there are many mantras. And if you actually type into Google Zen mantras, you'd be surprised. There they all are. Etc. And I'll just mention two. When Tim Burkett went to see his teacher, Suzuki Roshi, at the San Francisco Zen Center, Tim was saying, my mind is all over the place. And he didn't say it's like an elephant's trunk, but he could, etc. His teacher said, repeat the last line of the Heart Sutra, which goes, gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhi, sapaha, etc. And that means gone, gone. altogether gone to the other side, enlightenment, may it be so. And what's that mean? And again, it's not, we don't want to just learn the words. Remember, we have to have the meaning because we want that meaning to reach deeply down into our heart, right? Into our understanding. So gone, altogether gone refers to the Buddha's enlightenment before he dies. So altogether gone, he's gone, but his body is still there. And so when you say altogether gone to the other side, it's his para-nirvana when he actually dies, etc. And then, of course, enlightenment, and then may it be so really means it is so, and I usually translate it as so cool. It's so cool that the world is this way, if you will. Or you can use whatever expression. It is so. It's really great. And so I find it also pretty useful to actually, instead of using the Sanskrit, I use the English words, so it's much more. So you say gone, altogether gone to the other side. And all the time you're thinking about the Buddha and his enlightenment, and then his para-nirvana, enlightenment, etc. Man, just great, etc. And so Tim actually repeated this mantra. And we do it during the day, and we do it all the time. Another famous mantra, and one you can run into in yoga, is Om Mani Padme Hum, etc. And you hear this chanted in yoga. You know, it goes Om Mani Padme Hum. And what it means is the lotus in the heart. And it's a wonderful imagery. You can translate it as a lotus in muddy water. And a lotus is this great Buddhist image, basically, where We emerge through the body by dropping the body away, by dropping the mind away. We emerge out of that mud, if you will, and we become this beautiful, pure lotus, if you will, etc. What's the mud? The mud are the three poisons of Buddhism we talked about. It's attraction, it's aversion, it's delusion. Oftentimes, those three poisons are translated as greed for attraction or anger for aversion. I think just the slightest preference, there's no difference between the slightest preference and greed, the slightest dislike and anger, etc. So I tend to use the general words attraction, aversion, etc. This doesn't seem so, but as you practice and as you practice and as you practice, you find slight preferences are no different. You shed anger, but you still have slight preferences, etc., if you will. It's just a wonderful mantra. And again, I use the expression, in English I'll say, like a lotus in muddy water, like a lotus in muddy water. And then you just, but it's the imagery, etc., that comes up and sinks deeply into your heart, etc. And again, you want to use a traditional expression. There are lots of them. As I say, you can Google them, you can find a lot, you can try them. Once you have a mantra, it's good to stick with the mantra. And again, what you're doing is you're cultivating attention. I mean, remember, you're dealing with the trunk of an elephant. Well, a third practice is a practice of slowing down. And I think all of these are in the front of the sheet. The practice of slowing down. And we can all make a choice. And we all can make choices, etc. And many of us multitask. We run around. I ask people, and I say, what are you up to? And they say, oh, I'm just exhausted. You know, I've just done so much. And I talk about this, but I find myself watching TV, talking to my wife, eating supper, and doing the crossword puzzle. You know what I mean? Etc. So basically, we have to learn to slow down in our life. If we don't slow down, we don't have time to be reflective. And I think one of the great practices in slowing down that helps us learn to slow down is to learn mindful listening. Mindful listening. Where you actually listen to a person. I mean, you really listen to a person. Somebody once said, that there are two parts to a conversation, talking and waiting to talk, etc. That's not deep listening, right? And so often, and now of course when I say deep listening, you don't go to the coffee shop and order coffee and hang over the counter, etc. You know, trying to get at the nuances of the person making your coffee. But we all have relatives, you get together, etc. You have older parents, you have children, etc. One of the great expressions I've run across recently is the expression feeling felt. Feeling felt. And what that means is that when I say something and the other person responds in such a way as they know basically what I feel. And it's the same thing if you're a parent, etc. You have kids. You want the kid to feel felt. Etc. You just don't yell at them, stop doing that, etc. But you want to talk to them in such a way that you know you understand, you know, what they feel. And you're going to try to be compassionate, even though you might not let them do it. So feel felt, basically, if you will. So mindful listening, to me, is a powerful, powerful Zen practice that we can do every day, anytime. In our great image, in our kind of Buddhism, is the image of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva, basically, is one who stops the final parinirvana, except that you stop just short of enlightenment so you can dedicate yourself to helping others, etc. And how can we do that in our life? How can we do that easily in our life? And there's no better, more comforting way, etc., than learning mindful listening, etc. We can all do it, etc. And so we have to learn a practice, patience at every opportunity. And I might say one of the great advantages of reading, there are tons of books today on the brain-mind connection. And our abbot, Tim Burkett, actually talked about some of this last week, etc. One of the lessons you learn is that through habitual patterns, the way we interact with people and the way we react to things in general, that we really wear deep grooves in our brain, if you will. That we synapses that fire together, wire together, right? If you've heard that expression, etc. So by acting in habitual ways, actually we have these deep grooves. They're not easy to change, but they can be changed, etc. And so it really is helpful to realize that, you know, our brain has a structure. At any age, we can actually change it, etc. But it's not easy because it's like a rut, you know, on a road, a narrow country lane, you know, where some truck has worn a rut. You go down there and you fall in that rut, etc., etc. So be familiar with that. A fourth training is what we call one-pointed attention. And this is really mind training. And we can do that through, and it just means keeping your mind on a single thing, a thought, an object, whatever. Most of us, I have little control over where our attention goes. And this is one of the great things about being mindful and watching your mind during the day. And sometimes I think it would be great if we had a bell or some kind of sound where it made us stop, and we had to think, where's my mind now? Where is it? And we would finally have little control. It's like leaves in the fall that the wind blows along. It flits from object to object, etc. And if we're actually going to obtain, or if we're going to attain the dropping of body and mind, etc., you know, we have to learn to cultivate attention. Science, by the way, has discovered attention. And there are all kind of papers now in scientific journal on attention and the various aspects of attention. And we have a course this summer called Cultivating Attention that actually talks about a lot of this, if anyone is interested, etc. Basically, to live the spiritual life, we have to learn one-pointed attention, etc. And we're not going to progress down through stages of consciousness, etc. If we're going to plunge deeper and deeper, we have to work on cultivating attention. The fifth practice is training the senses. We have all kinds of things that arise, if you will, in our senses. Oftentimes that they want sweet things. You know, they want some drug or whatever. Our minds, in many ways, it's nice to compare them to puppies. And it's, you know, puppy is cute. You know, it chews your socks up. It pees in the corner. It does all kinds of things. And you figure that's puppy behavior. But when that puppy is 5 years old, if it chews your socks up and pees in the car, et cetera, it's in trouble, et cetera. We want to learn. And when I talked about dropping the body away, we have a responsibility to our body. We're not our body. So we have a responsibility towards it. We want to deny it harmful things, et cetera. We want to watch what we ingest. And if you actually read the literature, you eat when you're hungry, you know, and things like that. And we have to be vigilant, remember. Our mind is a trickster, and it's keep trying to trick us into, well, just one more donut, if you will. Remember, the body is the ultimate costume. It's a costume, etc. We have a responsibility for it. So treat it like a pet, if you will. It takes time. There are other senses too, of course, besides what we take in, through our mouth. We have to observe what we take in through our eyes, watching TV. Remember, your brain doesn't differentiate between the idea of something and the actual occurrence of that thing. So you watch violence, and you watch violence, etc., and that becomes imprinted. You have these deep, deep grooves, if you will, etc. We have to stand over the gate of our mouth, which is a very important one and a hard one. And there's an old Sufi saying that says, before you say anything, the words have to pass through three gates. And the first gate is the question, are the words true? You know, are you making it up? Are you just gabbing? You know, things like this, etc. Are you lying? The second gate is, are the words necessary? Are they necessary? Or are we just yakking, etc.? And then the third gate is, are the words kind? Are the words kind, etc.? So three gates, when we think about it. You know, are the words true? Are they necessary? Are they kind? Okay, the sixth practice is putting others first. And today in our society, it's easy to suffer from elephantitis of the eagle. This greatly inflated eagle, if you will. And of course, by concentrating on ourself, that is mind, etc., we alienate ourselves from what we call a supreme reality. The Buddha said, for those whom eagle overcomes, suffering spreads like weeds. And I like that. To those whom eagle overcomes, suffering spreads like weeds. Jesus said, if you want to find your life, you have to lose it. If you want to find your life, you have to lose it. Dogen said, and I think Susan Hagler mentioned this a few weeks ago, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things, etc. Gandhi was such a self-effacing individual, and he just had compassion for everybody. And so somebody asked him once, don't you have any ambition? And he said, oh no, he says, I have the greatest ambition in the world. I want to be zero. What he said was, I want to make myself zero. I want to make myself zero, etc. For me, one of the real bridges to help us lead us from thoughts about ourselves to thoughts of others is the practice of the four immeasurables. And it's a great practice. These are meditations on loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And so you say, for example, with loving kindness, you think of a loved one first and you say, may that person experience happiness in the ruts of happiness. And then it's more, there's longer things you can say. And then you include yourself. You say, may I experience happiness in the ruts of happiness. If you yourself aren't happy, and don't experience compassion, etc., and you can't give it to others. So you always include yourself in Buddhism. And then you think of a person you like, you know, that's not a loved one, and may that person experience happiness and the rest of happiness. And then you go back to that person serving your coffee at Dumb Brothers. And then you go to a person you don't like a little bit. And then eventually to a person you really can't stand. And so a lot of people find that when they get down in the depths there, they can't do it. It's hard. So that's part of the practice, etc. And it's the bridge, you know, through experience. And you do this with loving kindness. You do this with compassion. You do this with joy for others, others' happiness, etc., without any sense of reward, basically, for yourself. Remember John Donne's famous words, "No man is an island." Remember that? You know, we all are part of one. And Thich Nhat Hanh's famous expression is "inter are." We all inter are. We all inter are. If I pick up a piece of paper, Thich Nhat Hanh says, I see the tree. I see the forester. I see the forester's children. I see the sun that made the tree grow. I see the water and the nutrients that made the tree rise, etc. We all inter are. So we live in certitude, etc., that whatever we do, wherever we do it, it's going to have an effect, either good or bad, everywhere. Everywhere. So it's a way to basically live your life. And I think of this with the expression, be on fire with love for all. And I just love that. Be on fire with love for all. Just be on fire, if you will. Now, the seventh practice is spiritual companionship. And when we first start out, etc., we tell our friends, I go to the Zen Center and meditate, etc., they figure, geez, weird. Weird. And so basically one of the first real great principles of a spiritual life, etc., to join with others who are spiritually minded as well. Like a salmon, if we think of salmon swimming upstream, salmon swim in great numbers. And so we swim with others, but we always have to remember that we have to do the swimming, even though we're supported by others. Every Tuesday morning, we take three refuges. We say, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And the Sangha is our community, our supporting community, etc. If you can't come to the center, invite friends to your house. You know, have a little altar with flowers and candles, etc., in a little image. And I tend to think of all of us, when we start practicing, as one of those little plantings up north. I have a cabin like many people way up north. The foresters plant these little trees, and the deer come and gobble them up, right? And so what do they do? You go by and you see these little plastic tubes, etc., that protect basically that seedling. We're all seedlings, etc. We're all seedlings. And what protects us is that sangha around us, etc. And whether you do it at a Zen center or a church, some kind of church, etc., you know, we need that. So like a seed in the forest, surround ourselves with protective friends. And then the last of the spiritual practices is called reading the mystics, if you will. The path is a difficult one. We need reinforcement and inspiration all the time, etc. And you can draw this inspiration from any religion, any religion. And the way I look at religions is a great mountain. And we know certain sides of the mountain have a rain shadow. Some sides are wet. Some sides are dry. Some paths are straight up. Some paths wander, etc. And so different religions in the lower parts of mountains are covered with forests. And I think of those as different cultures and different practices, etc. But once you emerge above the tree line, and of course you're nearing the dome, the top of the mountain, etc., it's all one, if you will. There's an ancient Indian scripture that says, truth is one, though we call it by different names. Truth is one, though we call it by different names. there's only one supreme reality, etc. So you can be a Christian Buddhist. You can take this practice anywhere, if you will. And again, I found it's better not to rely on books about somebody, but actually go to the source. And there are basically two kind of readings we want to do, and if we don't distinguish them, it gets very confusing. One is reading for inspiration, and that's somebody who's writing from way up there in the witness, etc., in stages of consciousness, etc. So you read Dogen, and you're figuring, you know, what's he talking about? But you know, there's a lot. The other is reading for instruction. And let me just name just a few, basically. The Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is just wonderful. Because all of these people basically are, you know, they're writing from the witness, etc. Body and mind has dropped away. And it's wonderful. All of the writings about the life of Sri Ramana is just wonderful. Just wonderful to actually be exposed. In a lot of these cases, it's not the person writing. They didn't write. But it's a listener who wrote down what they heard, etc. I think one of the great spiritual books is The Way of Perfection by Teresa of Avila, etc., who's just wonderful. Or works by what another Teresa called The Little Flower, etc., called A Tale of a Soul. The Buddha's Dharmapada is just a wonderful source. Dogen Shobo Genso, the Hindu Upanishads, etc. So there are many good books. And I find at night before I go to bed, etc., you know, just read for a while, etc. Read a little bit. And again, you can read in any. Well, let me end by saying the main principle of the spiritual life is really pretty simple. And that is, you are what you think. You are what you think, etc. And through our practice, etc., by meditating on words that really embody these great ideals, etc., we can drive them deep into our consciousness and basically change the way we think. And I and other priests and priests-to-be, etc., welcome you on the journey. Thank you very much. We have a few minutes for any comments or thoughts or anything you might have. Well, a way to think of it, another image, and there's lots of nice imageries, is to think of the body as the chassis of a car, if you will, and think of the mind as the engine. And so the engine revs up and takes off, and no one's steering. Okay, our witness is the steerer; we're the person behind the wheel, etc. And so they'll let the engine just roam around, etc. You know what I mean? So we're all part of one. You know, we're a car, if you will. It's like we're all part of a package, etc. But we're the steerer. You know, we're not the chassis. We're not the engine. If that makes some sense.
I really think for that image because I have an 11-year-old boy whose car upsets him. I think that would really help him.
Okay, any other thoughts or comments? Okay, thank you.